Thanks for choosing us, The Takeaway, for your listening pleasure. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. There are an estimated 30 million Americans at risk today of serious and, in some cases, dangerous flooding as heavy rains and a four-year-old drought in a matter of hours in some areas. Violent weather, including tornadoes, torrential rain, and flooding, pummeled Texas and Oklahoma over the weekend and are threatening at least five more states. Hundreds of homes were destroyed. Authorities are still counting the dead and missing. Texas Governor Greg Abbott warned that more damage can be expected.
These river basins all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico are going to be facing challenging consequences as a result of this ongoing rain.
Governor Abbott has declared disaster areas in more than two dozen counties in Texas as forecasters predict the rain will continue throughout the week. Joining me now is Daniel Guerrero, mayor of San Marcos, Texas, a city between San Antonio and Austin that lies along the Blanco River and was among the hardest hit. Welcome, Mayor, and under the not happiest of circumstances, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So what is it that you're dealing with that's most serious at this moment?
At this point, the storms have passed for now. The water has begun to subside over the last few days. Yesterday, we did endure a tornado warning that actually did produce some funnel clouds and some tornadoes outside of the immediate municipal area, but certainly within visibility. So we've been dealing with that, dealing with a lot of recovery at this point. Many of our residents have returned to their homes, returned to their properties to assess damage, to go ahead and start making plans for the remainder of this week and quite possibly the remainder of the month in regards to their housing needs and reaching out to their insurance agents and insurance companies and things of that nature, and just planning to work towards cleanup. Our first responders are still addressing a number of different issues throughout the community, but I am happy to report that our utilities are working. People have power within the municipal boundaries. We do have water for them to be able to utilize for consumption, and we'll just continue to work with the county and with the state and with our surrounding communities to address other issues and to work collaboratively.
Good news there from Daniel Guerrero, mayor of San Marcos, Texas. Explain to us throughout the country here how it is that Texas really can't handle this kind of rain. You've had a drought up until now. Places like Houston are in lowlands. They're swampy areas. Some of these cities really just can't handle even small amounts of rain. And this has been just way beyond any record. Help us to understand.
Well, I think your last comment there kind of hits it right on the nail. This is our flood of record. This surpasses any measurable floodwaters that we saw in 1998, in the 70s when we had some significant flooding, and it goes back way into 1929. No one has ever seen this level of water breach the banks of the Blanco River and cause the San Marcos River to back up. So this is like nothing anybody in this community or for generations have ever had to endure or experience. We have been very fortunate to have first responders throughout Central Texas that have, you know, stood up to the storm, gone in, rescued folks, saved lives, and a lot of the technology and communications efforts that helped move people early and forewarn people of the forthcoming floodwaters really assisted greatly. I'm so proud of every personnel, every man and woman in uniform that has assisted us, and especially also our neighbors that have come to the aid of their neighbors and their friends and family, just to provide comfort, to provide resources, encouragement, and to stand ready for our cleanup efforts.
But I hear you saying that people driving Route 10 in the next couple of years are still going to see signs of this unprecedented flooding from Houston to San Antonio to your town, San Marcos. Throughout this whole region?
For a period. I think for a period of time, some of the debris is being collected, we have Texas disposal systems here in San Marcos that is providing a large level of resources to help clean up neighborhoods, to help clean up roadsides, but certainly some of the natural assets that we have. There were trees in Wimberley, especially, which is immediately west of San Marcos and was hit probably harder than San Marcos, trees that were just mowed down like blades of grass. And I think the governor mentioned that specific comment yesterday. And so there are aspects that have beautified our community for so long that are no longer there that we'll have to adjust to. But as far as the debris, as far as some of the damaged homes, we're going to get in there. We're going to address them as friends and neighbors and nonprofit organizations and church communities and municipalities and counties and states to get together and to rebuild our community and to move forward after this devastating flood.
But nobody's missing the drought, right, Mayor?
No, sir. Nobody's missing the drought at this time.
Daniel Guerrero, Mayor of San Marcos, Texas, in the middle of the flood zone. Thanks so much, sir.
Thank you.
To the Middle East now, following a period of seeming military quagmire in Iraq and Syria, the militants of ISIS now seem to have control in more than half of Syrian territory, including the ancient city of Palmyra. They also control Ramadi in Iraq. That's the capital of Anbar province. How could this so-called Islamic State seem to find a foothold despite a coalition of forces fighting it from the air and ground? More disturbing, why, despite months of U.S. attacks against ISIS targets with airstrikes, is the main headquarters of the Islamic State in eastern Syria completely unscathed?
Dropping bombs is really not going to kill the Islamic State. And so it seems that the Islamic State is going to maintain its control over the eastern half of Syria, more or less indefinitely.
That's former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, part of a frontline special report on the dubious and tentative U.S. approach to the Syrian civil war. Writer and director Martin Smith says the Obama approach helped fuel the chaos in Syria and then, by hesitating, gave ISIS an opportunity on the ground. Martin Smith, longtime filmmaker for Frontline, producer of this new documentary, Obama at War, which airs tonight, is with me now in the studio. Martin, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So how did the Obama approach help ISIS or play into its hands? Because in some ways, if you lined up the tactics and materiel of ISIS a few years ago, you wouldn't have thought they'd have a chance.
They grew very quickly over the last couple of years and took everybody in the U.S. intelligence apparatus by total surprise. There was no – as I sat down with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, and I said, you know, for all the contingency planning that you do here at the Pentagon, was there any sort of idea that ISIS was gathering as they were? And when they took Mosul in June of last year, he says they basically were very surprised. So, you know, they didn't come out of nowhere. This is the old al-Qaeda in Iraq that was sort of on the ropes after the by the time the Americans left. But then they slowly began to rebuild, and then they moved into Syria. And the chaos of that war allowed them to gather strength. But whether you can really lay that at the president's feet, I think, is a open question.
Well, let's listen to the narrative here. You've got, first of all, the president didn't learn about Syria from reading it in the newspapers. There were warnings throughout the political establishment here in the United States. Here's John McCain.
I told the president, I said, Bashar Assad is slaughtering people. We are watching genocide take place. And it is going to eventually destabilize the entire region.
And then you have the president responding to chemical attacks, which, of course, changed the game. And Americans remember that very well.
We have been very clear to the Assad regime that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
And evidence of chemical weapons did, at least as we were told, change the equation. But here's Martin Dempsey talking with you, Martin Smith, about a hesitation that seems to have been critical in looking as to what happened after that.
It was a Friday night, and I got a call from the President of the United States, and he said to me, I am considering an alternative course of action. And he wanted me overnight to consider whether a delay would in any way affect our ability to be effective with our military options.
Now, what's he talking about there?
That was an 11th-hour order, a phone call from President Obama to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon saying, stand down. The ships were in position in the Mediterranean. The missiles were loaded. They were ready to strike at the regime to prevent them from using their chemical weapon stockpile, which they had been using. The president had warned. You know, he said, that's going to change my calculus. But at the 11th hour, he rethought this and thought he didn't have enough political cover. So he decided to go to Congress to get their approval, which most of his aides said would be political suicide because you're not going to get the support of Congress because the American people don't want the United States to wade into another Middle Eastern conflict.
And as a journalist, you know this probably better than anyone else. America is fatigued with Iraq and
totally.
Afghanistan, and political cover is laughable at this point. So did ISIS at any point take the United States threat seriously as it moved forward to gather territory in Syria and Iraq?
When you talk to people in the Syrian opposition, this is the moderate Syrian
right.
opposition, they feel very much that the jihadi elements, the extremist elements, and that includes ISIS. There are other groups as well. But they took advantage of the decision not to strike. They said to the people in Syria, look, the Americans don't have your back. They say they're going to come and they're going to put down the dictator's use of chemical weapons, and then at the 11th hour, they decide not to do that. So we have your back. Come with us. And in a very beleaguered, long-suffering population of Sunnis in Syria, facing all sorts of assaults from the regime, they increasingly give their support, and it allows ISIS to gain strength.
And would you say that at this point there is a viable option right now, either to contain ISIS, to bring some sort of peaceful settlement to Syria? Is anyone talking about an end game anywhere here?
Well, I think there are diplomatic opportunities to negotiate with the Russians, who are a major supplier to the regime. And the president has put his money on a nuclear deal with Iran. The idea of bringing Iran into the community of nations as a solution more broadly to conflicts in the Middle East, that is one reason he has focused more of his attention on Iran than on Syria. But it's anyone's guess. Right now, the policy is one of containment, and certainly we can contain ISIS. I mean, they control 50% of Syria now and a large swath of Iraq. But these are desert areas without a lot of population. They can be contained. I don't think Baghdad is about to fall.
But The Economist describes Iraq as a proxy state of Iran at this moment, and the control that ISIS has in Syria and Iraq, a Sunni jihadist state for the indefinite future. And Richard Ford described it that, Ambassador Ford described it that in your story. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you have to agree. I mean, look, Abadi, the prime minister of Iraq, gets a lot of support. His most viable fighting force, other than the Kurds in the north, which are somewhat autonomous, are the Shia militia that are backed by Iran.
Martin Smith is a filmmaker and producer of the new Frontline documentary, Obama at War. You can see it tonight on public television stations. Thank you, Martin.
Thanks, John.
And later this hour, the city of Cleveland settles with the Justice Department over matters of excessive violence in the police department, but it's not just a matter for the police.
All of us have a responsibility, not just the politicians, but the business community has to step forward, the foundations, the clergy. We all have to take responsibility for leading.
More with Cleveland pastor Richard Gibson later on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
An estimated 400,000 children in the United States are in the foster care system. According to the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, children of color are disproportionately represented in the system in more than half of the states. New Jersey is one of those states, and on any given month, there are approximately 7,000 kids in foster care. 3 in 5 are black or Hispanic. An investigation by New Jersey Public Radio's Sarah Gonzalez explores this disparity. Sarah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Let's talk first about what disproportionate means. Are they studying blacks, Hispanics, and white kids adjusted for all of the possible causes that might lead to being into foster care and looking at the disparity that way?
So we looked at every child who entered foster care in New Jersey over the course of 5 years and the race or ethnicity of each of those children and the reasons why their parents lost custody. And we found that black children are more than 4 times as likely as white children to be removed from their parents. The state does not actually break down whether it's black children in poverty or black children in single parent households or anything like that. But we spoke to a policy advocate in Washington, D.C. His name is Aronde Miller. He works for the Alliance for racial equity and child welfare. And he said that there are things that New Jersey could be doing to kind of test whatever assumptions they might have about who is entering the child welfare system.
So exploring this disproportionate representation is not done by the state. But when you did it, you found clearly that there is an overrepresentation on the part of black children.
Yeah. The black child population in New Jersey is 14%, and yet black children make up more than 40% of those in foster care in the state.
We're going to hear from Aronde Miller, who gives us a big picture of what's going on in the system in just a moment. But first, let's hear the fears of a mother that you took a look at here. This is Latifah.
Like, literally go hurry up and knock on doors and ask, okay, let me, you know, hold your meat real quick, or let me borrow your canned goods real quick, just so I can have something in the refrigerator for when they come.
So she's talking about the fear of inspection.
Right. So she lost custody of all three of her children, and she lost custody for testing positive for marijuana and for Percocet, a painkiller, in the delivery room. And she's been working for almost a year to regain custody of her kids. She gets these home inspections, and she and other mothers I spoke with say the first thing that caseworkers in New Jersey do, black mothers, the first thing they do during these home inspections is open the refrigerator, open the pantry to look for food. Now, technically, these mothers should be allowed to talk to their caseworkers and say, I need help providing for my children, and the state should help put them on food stamps or give them services that they might need. But there's so much fear. They don't want to give the state any other reason to think that they're not fit to parent their children.
And did it surprise you as a reporter that, I mean, did she have a prescription for Percocet?
She says that she had a prescription for Percocet during her pregnancy at one point during her pregnancy. But then that prescription ended and she was getting a generic brand. In the case of this mother, once she lost custody of her son, she kind of spiraled a little bit, and people who represent parents and advocates for parents and advocates for children say that this is something that tends to happen when parents lose custody of their kids. In the case of Latifah, the state started considering adoption, and that kind of made her snap out of it. And that made her say, like, okay, I need to clean up. I need to do something because I cannot have my kids go into adoption. So that's one thing that I'll clarify. We looked at kids who were temporarily removed from their parents. So not parents who lost their parental rights, which is a much more serious situation.
But still, a traumatic situation. And you hear it in the voice there of Latifah. Let's listen to Jamela, who's another mother who is, representative of when you begin to look at the economic statistics here between various families and various racial groups, you begin to see how the disparity works.
Like, you'll see a Caucasian person in the supermarket and their children don't have on a hat or shoes and it's cold outside. You know, let that happen to an African-American. Before you know it, they're reading your license plate and boom, you have social worker knocking on your door.
So in this case, the state, when we presented the state with our findings, the state said, well, you can't just look at the race or ethnicity of the children who are entering the system. You have to look at there are risk factors involved, single parent households, family structures, substance abuse, socioeconomic conditions. And they said, you know, that tends to be a better indicator of who ends up in foster care than race or ethnicity alone. But Aronde Miller with the Alliance for Racial Equity and Child Welfare in Washington, he said that the state of Texas, they decided to analyze their data, their practices, to test whether or not poverty was actually leading to who was ending up in foster care. And they found that poverty didn't account for the racial disparity in their system. They found that caseworkers and judges were instead treating poor black parents differently than poor white parents. And policy advocates say that this is because of people's judgments of
subjective judgments of how certain factors play in racial groups versus other racial groups. Here's Aronde Miller.
Somehow we think that the impact of the substances on a white mother's ability to care for and nurture her child are so much different than the impact of substances on an African-American mother.
Now, when he says we, who's he talking about there?
He's talking about society in general, but it's specifically caseworkers and judges and the people who play a role in who's entering the foster care system. I will say that it's not just the caseworkers. People can get introduced to the child welfare system with one phone call. It can come from a neighbor, a school, a hospital. Anyone can call a state hotline in New Jersey and allege that a child might be in danger. So they could say, I have a neighbor. I think they're smoking marijuana in the home and there's a 2-year-old there. And with that, caseworkers are obligated to go out and investigate each allegation that comes into a state hotline and determine whether or not to remove the child at that point.
As a reporter, did you find credible this idea that at a supermarket, if your kid's not wearing a hat, if you're African-American, that someone's going to report on you and you're going to get a knock at the door?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to a coworker, and they were saying how one of their friends was on the train in New York City and that their child refuses to wear shoes, and that some lady on the train said, I work for Child Protective Services and you need to put shoes on your child right now. And this is before I was fully launched into this investigation. And we were thinking, you know, I wonder what the role of race was in that situation. And then when I heard all of these Black mothers in particular talking about how they feel like they can't do certain things that white parents can do, you know, that's certainly what they feel.
Sarah Gonzalez, reporter for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio on the disproportionate representation of Blacks in the foster care system in New Jersey, representing a problem that's nationwide. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Of course.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Cleveland is in the spotlight as yet another community demonstrates how it deals with police violence, tension between law enforcement and citizens, and verdicts that make people angry.
When there are large numbers of people who do not think the system works for them and in some ways works against them, we have to respond to it.
Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich on ABC's This Week program, speaking just before reports began surfacing that the city has reached a settlement with the Justice Department over use of excessive force and civil rights violations. The settlement comes days after a judge acquitted policeman Michael Brelo, a patrolman charged with manslaughter in the fatal shooting of two unarmed African-Americans in a completely wild car chase back in 2012. There have been protests and arrests. All parts of Cleveland society have been mobilized to minimize violence, including the riding high Cleveland Cavaliers NBA basketball team. How is the community doing? Pastor Richard Gibson preaches at Elizabeth Baptist Church in Cleveland. Pastor, how you doing?
Thank you for having me on your show.
Are people holding it together here?
Yes, people are holding it together, but there's certainly great concern about the murders that have taken place in our community.
And would you say that there is a lot of unanimity in the community? There was talk on the floor of the Cleveland Cavaliers basketball game. I heard civic leaders from both parties talking about keeping the peace. It does appear as though lessons maybe have been learned in Cleveland from some other cases around the country. What's your assessment?
So while it's important to be peaceful, we think that the brutality that we've seen in our community has to be addressed by looking at the underlying symptoms. So we think that there has to be systematic and comprehensive criminal justice reform. There has to be improvements in education. And there have to be more jobs for persons, particularly in the city.
What do you make of Kasich's remark that if large numbers of people do not think the system works for them, we, and I'm presuming he means the governor's office and the power structures in Ohio, have to respond to it? Is he sounding sensitive there, or is he basically trying to, just sort of calm things down with rhetoric?
I think that the piece that I heard resonates with me a bit, because all of us have a responsibility for taking care of the problems that exist on our watch. So there has to be proactive leadership at all levels, and not just the politicians, but the business community has to step forward, the foundations, the clergy. We all have to take responsibility for leading, and this is a time to lead.
You talked about jobs in Cleveland. Do people view the police in Cleveland as folks who are from their community, or do they live in the suburbs and commute in?
So there's a mixture. There used to be a residency requirement, and that went away. It was challenged. Certainly there are persons who live in the city who are also police officers. We have members of our congregation who are police officers as well. And so there is concern about whether there is a disconnect between the police and the community. And we think that that is part of the opportunity for comprehensive reform.
And how do you repair that disconnect? How do you address that disconnect?
Well, some of it is meeting with them. Greater Cleveland Congregations, as part of the its dialogue with the mayor, suggested that there has to be what we call constitutional policing, that there have to be reforms in terms of the structure. There also has to be internal accountability, which there hasn't been. A third point is that there has to be community engagement. There's little or no community engagement between the police and the persons whom they serve. There has to be transparency and accountability. And there also has to be financial stability, because the police officers are sometimes ill-equipped to do their job in this city. And so those are the specific recommendations that we've made.
Well, good luck to you. And let's hope that reform becomes more of a theme than, you know, keeping the lid on, as we've heard from so many politicians in the last few days. Pastor Richard Gibson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pastor Richard Gibson preaches at the Elizabeth Baptist Church in Cleveland, Ohio.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Japanese, Java, and juggling. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian is scheduled to go on trial today in Iran, but it will be no show trial. Rezaian has been held for more than 10 months, accused of espionage and other charges, but his trial proceedings will be secret. Rezaian is a dual U.S.-Iranian citizen, and since his arrest on July 22, 2014, he's only had one meeting with his attorney. A second meeting took place today in the courtroom. Being a dual citizen may have been an advantage for Rezaian as a reporter in terms of access to stories, and his work for the Washington Post was remarkable. But that same dual citizenship may make him more vulnerable to the whims of what passes for a justice system in Iran. Joining us now is Ali Rezaian, Jason Rezaian's brother, and an advocate for his release. Ali, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you say his dual citizenship helps or hurts him in this particular case right now?
You know, it certainly complicates things. The Iranians don't accept our American citizenship, despite the fact that Jason was born in California and raised there and never set foot in Iran until he was 25, 26 years old. What they say is they treat dual nationals as Iranian citizens. But in this particular case, not even that is the case.
So how much of a gray area is it? Reporters would have the need to talk to dissidents, political critics of the regime, all kinds of individuals who might be controversial in Egypt, to talk with the opposing party has become now an illegal, crime. Are we looking at this kind of a situation in Iran right now?
It seems like that's what they're saying. Certainly, they try and control the news a lot over there. But as you point out, to be a reporter, you have to get information from a lot of different sources. And that's what Jason did. He had a network of people who he spoke with. He never had access to secret information, never passed anything along that was not really public information. And so these charges are just ridiculous.
And do reports from journalists from Western news outlets who are accredited in Tehran have to submit their reports to censors, as is the case in places like Israel?
No, that's not the case. There's certainly, I think, a process that people go through to understand what the government would like them to print and what they would like them not to print. And they always risk having their credentials pulled. But in terms of Western journalists, it's much more typical that somebody would have their credentials pulled or potentially lose their visa to leave the country. Given that Jason is a dual national, they can't really do that. And in this case, that gave them the opportunity to put him in jail. But we don't believe that there was anything about his reporting, per se, that is what caused them to take him in the first place. It's really kind of random as to why that happened.
Why the secret trial? What could be the justification for that, and how is it being played in the media?
You know, we only found out yesterday that it was going to be a secret trial. All we said what we wanted was transparency. It's really very unfortunate. Jason wants to prove that he's innocent. He wants to get as much information out as possible. The only thing that I can say is that it seems as if the Iranian government wants to continue controlling the information and really prevent people from seeing that there just is no evidence against Jason. He had no access to secret information, which is really the only justification in their law system to hold the trial as a closed trial.
Now, you said that the Iranians, in theory, had the option of pulling his credentials and just kicking him out of the country. But because he's a dual citizen, they didn't have that option, or they chose not to use that option?
Technically, they can't kick him out of the country because he's a Iranian citizen. But they could easily pull his credential. I mean, that's something that can be done in 15 minutes. There's a credentialing agency called Ershad. Jason had very good relationships with them. He was constantly in communication with them, as are most Western or foreign journalists. They don't run their stories by them, but they have to ensure that they're following the rules in Iran. And there are geographic limitations as to where they can report and things like that. Jason really didn't have problems with them. He had just had his credentials renewed the day before he was arrested. So it's clear that this didn't have anything to do with something that he wrote, per se.
Iran, having been there as a reporter for some short period of time, is a place rife with conspiracy theories about all kinds of backroom dealing in politics. What's the sense that this may have something to do with the nuclear negotiations taking place between the United States and Iran, and that he is suddenly a bargaining chip somewhere?
You know, I mean, clearly, as you said, there's a lot of paranoia over there, and there are a lot of different factions within the government. Whatever kicked this off, whether it was some kind of internal politics between, say, the Revolutionary Guard and the executive branch or some other item, I think that really it's just kind of spiraled out of control for them. Because Jason was very careful in what he did, because Jason was, a law-abiding citizen, I think it's been difficult for them to find something to pin on him, and that's just kept it going on and on and on. Clearly, the international situation, the multilateral talks that are going on, complicate things. They make it much more difficult. But, you know, in no way did Jason have anything to do with the U.S. government. And, you know, both governments have always said that the communication about detained citizens is a separate conversation than the negotiations over nuclear material, et cetera.
What is his condition? How is your family dealing with all of this?
Obviously, being isolated in almost solitary confinement for 10 months has been very difficult on Jason, I think, both physically and mentally. But what I can say is that, you know, my mom went to Iran to see Jason. She's been there for 2 weeks now, and she was allowed to see him last week for about an hour. What she told me is that, you know, while, mentally it's difficult for him, he's clearly depressed. He's angry with both governments. But what we heard loud and clear is that Jason wants to prove his innocence. He's by no means given up. He has hope. And what he wants to do is go into this trial, have a vigorous defense, and do everything he can to clear his name.
Finally, what could the Obama administration do that it's not doing now in either Jason's view or your view?
You know, I think the more that the Iranian government realizes that these kinds of activities make it difficult for anybody, Americans or other countries, to do business with them going forward, and that these kinds of activities really just it make it impossible for them to become a functioning part of the world community, which is their stated goal. I think the more that the government can do that and really convince them of that, and that there's an upside to stopping these kinds of things, is the best thing that the Obama administration can do, as well as our partners and other folks who are trading partners with Iran.
Ali Rezaian is the brother of Jason Rezaian, who's been imprisoned in Tehran for the last 10 months. Jason is a Washington Post journalist accused of espionage, and his brother Ali is advocating for his release. Ali, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing basic tools for individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, and more. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.